Yeah.
Okay. Welcome to Job, the class. Again, I will say that has all questions and no answers. So we remember we're working on our little dilemma, which is we have to figure out which of these three things to reject. One is that Job was righteous. The second is that God is fair and just. And the third is that God is all-powerful. And you know that his friends rejected the first, that Job was righteous. Job kind of rejects the second. We'll see some of that, less of that tonight than we've seen in the earlier speeches, where he just keeps saying, God's not being fair about this. In fact, I wish I could just kind of have a discussion with him and put my case there. And, you know, in some way, maybe he could vindicate his own self in that way. And then, of course, the kind of the modern person, I would almost say the wicked person, who, by the way, curses God. Remember, we'll talk about what that meant as a review again. Probably believes in not in the limited power of God, right? What does it matter? He can't do anything to me. But generally, that's the modern view, which is God's just limited. So you're trying to figure out which to reject. How many of you think you know the answer to that so far? Which of the three to reject? You think you know?
I think I know.
Remember, part of this class is people who think they know the answer.
Well,
okay, you think you know?
Well, I mean, it's just a process of elimination.
Oh, I see.
Because two of them are right out.
So it's just one of those choose the least worst answer.
It's the ACT.
All right, that's good. Yeah, that's probably the right approach. I should have made four because there's normally one you can rule out because it's stupid. Then there's one or two that sound pretty good.
Indeed.
And I don't know why my little... but thanks for your patience on that. And I promise it will all come together.
Switching.
There we go. So this is our catechism. And again, I apologize for pestering you with this, but really I think these 10 or 12 questions, they form an integrated whole that help us understand the book. And I hope you've begun to see relationships between some of these catechism answers. And once again, I'm being too cute, and I actually misspelled catechism. It should be E, I think, the second
name.
C-A-T-E. But anyway, Satan's claim, just let's go through it right quick. What is his claim? And it's really in the form of a question. Serve God for nothing. And the answer Satan thinks is
no.
And so the right answer, because Satan always lies, is Job does serve God for nothing. Wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. That's a little bit puzzling. Mm-hmm. Keep that in your head. Because really, if you think about it, how does that relate to the theology of retribution? What does the theology of retribution say you're supposed to serve God for? For something, right? And if you don't, if you're wicked, then you get punished. Or you get the nothing, or even worse than nothing, right? So you see, these are kind of related. And I think Satan presumed that all these folks held this theology of retribution, and if it got turned upside down in their life, that'd be the end of their service to God, because they're not getting any benefit for it, right? So that's one thing to think about. Job's wife's question, do you still retain your integrity? And that was a key word, because we keep seeing this word integrity throughout the whole book, and we'll see it again tonight a couple of times. Mostly now, Job's saying, I still maintain that I'm blameless. That's the same word, Hebrew word, tam. And what it means is, of course, completeness, wholeness, and perfection, most closely related to the fact that he is blameless before God. But there's a larger sense in which he's a whole person. And of all the people in the book that you kind of look at and think, I don't think he's whole, who would it be? Who suffered the most, had the most taken away, his identity's been stripped from him, his pride, his acceptance, his family, everything. And yet, he's the one that keeps claiming he's whole. What makes him whole, given all these things have been taken away? Right? And of course, it's related to
God.
It's related to what it means to curse God and what he's afraid of most and all that. That's kind of the wholeness of that picture. So what he feared most was not that he'd get scabs and boils, not that he wanted that, but is that he would lose his relationship. We're going to see that tomorrow tonight. What's interesting is, when he claims his blamelessness, he still keeps saying, and I still believe in and fearing of God. So you understand, in that wholeness, maintaining his blamelessness, he keeps saying, and I'm still faithful to God. I am still faithful to God, he keeps saying. So cursing God means saying goodbye. We're going to see, we saw it in the end of the last second cycle, we'll see it again today. I think maybe Job is, Eliphaz is coming back and quoting Job. He'll say, the wicked say this to God, leave us alone. Did you see that in the last speech? You'll see it again tonight. I think that's an example of what cursing God would look like. Get out of my life. I don't want that relationship. And then we know this already, and you can see how now that's related to Satan's question. And the sayings are mostly, of course, our own observation and our own belief, somewhat based on what maybe a vision from God would be, right? And that's, once again, the vision, that the only vision we have in the book is coming up, and we'll see how that really relates to this. But he quotes the vision. Perhaps he misinterprets the vision, but that's a source that he quotes. The three conflicting assumptions we just talked about. What is Eliphaz's vision? Can you kind of quote it? I'd like you to be able to, because whenever it comes, something like that comes up, what do you think? What's his vision? It's actually his coming. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Right? That's kind of the main idea. And he goes on to say, look, God finds fault with angels. And later he's going to say, man, he can make the sun and the moon go dim. Right? So you can't make yourself righteous compared to God, or out-righteous him, or claim something that he knows better. And it's interpreted in various different ways, but can a mortal be more righteous than God? That's kind of the idea there. Okay, I've colored this blue, because I'm assuming we got this last time. We're finally seeing what it is Job's friends did wrong, and there's an emphasis on this in the speeches. What did they do wrong? Did they misquote Scripture? No, in fact, they quoted Scripture, probably pretty accurately, right? They didn't do that. Did they blaspheme God? Did they charge God as being an evil person? No, in fact, almost the opposite. They're almost just like too firmly convinced that he always does the right thing and never does the wrong thing. Although we wouldn't disagree with that, would we? You know, we'd be kind of careful. So it isn't that. What is it that they did wrong? Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you could say, well, they based it on experience. Yeah, that's good. How long have they lived and how much experience have they had? And how far can they take the interpretation given? But that's it. They spoke for God. And I almost said they presumed erroneously to speak erroneously. But what they said ended up probably being somewhat wrong. But they were presuming to speak for God, and that's the main thing. Okay, I think we have two more questions. This won't come till the end. It's two, three lessons away. But we can start to see, I think, maybe what Job did wrong, looking back and thinking about the arguments. Anybody have any ideas of maybe... Because, you know, Job repents in the end, too, in dust and ashes. And he says, I'm putting my hand over my mouth, meaning that he said something he shouldn't have said, I think. What is that? I think that's important, too, this whole story. If you don't know, that's okay. But keep thinking about that question, because that's the one we're working on next. All right, here's the diagram again. You're probably tired of this, but we're down here to the third cycle. Remember that there's kind of a theory that a lot of the important things might be in the middle of the book, and I really want to get to 28 tonight. And if I have to skip stuff, that'll be okay. So, you know, like 5 till or so, we're just going to go to chapter 28. And then Bill will finish with 29. And on, which is Job's final defense. We'll do that, I think it's like a couple of weeks away. It's after the meeting. It's a Sunday after the meeting. And if you have that lesson already, lesson 7, but I have lesson 8 if you need it in advance, besides if it's online as well. Okay, so that's where we are. You notice the interesting thing about cycle 3? What's different here? Yeah, Zophar, he passes, I guess you could say. That's one view would be. He just can't think of anything. Bildad gets pretty small. Remember, he is the shortest man in the Bible, as we learned earlier. Right? But he doesn't say very much, and then Zophar says nothing. Or it could be that some of what we have attributed to Job could be Zophar's final speech. But I don't think we know for sure, and I don't think it matters. It makes it a little difficult to interpret Job's final words, but I think we can establish some kind of a meaning at the end of chapter 27. Someday, I would like to sit down and go verse by verse and make a kind of a mapping of all the arguments and counter-counter-arguments. You know what I mean? Maybe a big graph that says, well, he said this, but then later he quoted him and said this. And I keep wanting to do that, and I get started, and it's just overwhelming, and then I can't remember where stuff is. But here are some ideas, I think, that reflect the fact that the arguments are evolving a little bit. First of all, Job kind of begins by saying, I'm getting something I don't deserve. And he begins then to kind of say, you know what, I guess God does destroy the wicked, but he destroys the innocent too. And really, the wicked die, and they're pretty peaceful at the time, and sometimes they live and grow stronger until they die. And we're going to read 24 tonight, but that is the crown. I believe that's like the death blow, Job delivers to the argument. It's a pitiful, beautiful but pitiful section of text. And it describes a terrible world, and it's probably the most accurate description of the world in the book, if you look at it, from our point of view, of course. Job asserts his own righteousness, and he goes through all this, show me my sin. And he says things like, I've been wronged by God. I'll never be wicked. I'll never admit that I was wicked. We'll come along later at the end, his final speech. And then the friends, do you remember how Eliphaz began? He began by saying, I would like to talk to him just a minute. Now, you have been a great helper to people in the past. So all I'm trying to do, well, that's gone. And when we get to Eliphaz tonight, he just starts out just like accusing them. And I almost think he was saying, and he took money from the widows, and then like watch him and see if he flinches. That's it. I knew that was it. Then that didn't work. But he tries another thing. Well, if he flinches that, no. But he starts trying out things. And then he says, if a wicked man, not to mention any names, but if he does repent, God will restore him. And by the way, a good evidence was, you know why your children were killed, don't you? You know what I mean? And so he's kind of slowly getting, or the friends are slowly coming around and saying, come on, just tell us what you did and repent. And so that's where we get to when we get to this third speech. So that's there. And then here's my beginning of the challenge and reply. The friends are saying, this is, by the way, the first statement right in the early part of Eliphaz's first speech. Look, this is it. Theology of retribution. Innocent never perish. The upright are never destroyed. You got that? It's that easy. Right? What's the easy answer to that? It doesn't happen that way. God destroys both. Your words, the way you're talking, condemn you. Well, here's a reason. Because I'm hurting. Would you condemn a man who's suffering like I am just for some of the things he says? You're not being honest about your sins. God knows and judges. Hey, I will put my life on the line to face any charges. Look at me. Do I look like somebody who'd be in a position to lie right now? What good would it do me? And, you know, one of the commentaries suggested, you know, his friends are kind of scooting back in the ash heap, saying, in case the lightning comes down and takes him out, whoa, back away from this guy. Because he's kind of saying, okay, I'm not going to... And he's calling down God's wrath if he's wrong. I wish God would show you your sins. And Job says, so do I, because I don't know what they are. What if he examined you? How would you look? Which is ironic, because what happens at the end, he says, you know, I'm mad with these guys, and you better offer a sacrifice for them. Right? God will yet reward and exalt you if you repent. And Job says, no, if I'll suffer whether I'm guilty or innocent, even if I were innocent, he'd find something wrong. It's the way it feels at the moment anyway. The wicked always suffer and die, 24 through 6. And then, of course, Job is going to say, well, no, not really. That's not being experienced. And ask a few people who have their eyes open, and you'll see that's not true. And then, of course, the old pushing and shoving about who knows more than somebody else, right? I know what you don't know. You don't know what... Are you going to kind of have to undo all the laws of physics because of your little experience here and all that? And he just says, you know, I know everything you know. And there's a kind of a going back and forth about that. So that's just an example. So let's look at Eliphaz. I just want to go backward in a little bit. Chapter 21, the very end of Job's speech. Because I think, in a way, Eliphaz picks up on a few of these comments when he goes there. Now, Job is talking about the wicked in verse 13 of 21. Okay, so let's all just read this together. He's talking about how pleasant their life is, and lots of children, and music, and dancing, verse 13, the years and prosperity, and they go down to the grave in peace. Yet, they say to God, leave us alone. And I believe that's an example of cursing God in our sense, saying goodbye to God. That's it. They've said that, and yet all this, you know, and then they also go and say, what would we gain by praying to him? Do you see a little bit of a perverted theology of retribution in that? The wicked says, I don't get anything bad or good, and so they just do bad. And if I prayed to God, it wouldn't make any difference, right? I wouldn't be any better off, is what they're saying. This is what Job is saying, the wicked are saying, you know, and maybe they are questioning God's power. And they say, who is the Almighty that we should serve? What would we gain by praying to him? but their prosperity is not in their own hands. So I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. And I have no idea what that phrase means, but it will be said again by Eliphaz. So it's almost like he's saying, you know, he's almost like saying, I know this is what the righteous person would say or something. Maybe it's a kind of an endorsement of his own statement. Anyway, and then the famous kind of counter quote, verse 17, how often is the lamp of the wicked snuffed out? How often does calamity come upon them? And of course, chapter 24 will be the place where he comes back to that. Look down to verse 29. This is Job now again speaking. Have you never questioned those who travel? That's interesting to me because we travel virtually with our, you know, internet and CNN and whatever. And we see a lot more misery, I think, in the world than we would have maybe 50 or 70 years ago. We see it like videos of it. And in some ways, our awareness of what Job is saying is even more because we travel. And he's saying, you know, listen to the people who come from other places. This is the way the whole world is. You may not have this in your little life, in your little community, but open your eyes to the people from faraway places, and that's the way the world. Okay, third cycle begins. Eliphaz replies, can a man be a benefit to God? Can a wise man benefit God or him? What pleasure would it give the Almighty if you were righteous? What would he gain if your ways were blameless? I have to stop there, and I'm going to go a little beyond what's maybe obvious here. If you truly believe in the theology of retribution to the extreme that God is just a mechanical response to your righteousness or unrighteousness, what does that say about God's character? Is he emotional about it? Does he really care if you're righteous or not? Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But it almost looks like Eliphaz is saying, you know what? We're so little, it doesn't matter to God what we do. You just do bad, he punishes you. You do good, and you're rewarded. And I think if you take that argument to the extreme, you end up with God just being mechanical. And if you're a sinner, he just hates you and punishes you. He doesn't love you, he doesn't want you to, you know what I mean? And then if you finally come to your senses and decide you want your stuff back, then he likes you. If you do right. You see what I'm getting? It's a little bit of a stretch, but I don't think that's too far out from just having this mechanical view. That's just a side point. Maybe it's not true. But here's the point. Is it through your piety that he rebukes you? Remember, piety was a word Eliphaz used at the beginning to describe how Job's piety had been of assistance to others. And he brings charges. Is not your wickedness great, or not your sins endless? You demand security from your brothers for no reason. You strip men of their clothing, leaving them naked. Right? You gave them no water. You know, you withheld food from the hungry. You know, and I'm watching to see if he'll flinch on any of these. Though you were a powerful man, owning land, honored man, living on it, you sent widows away empty-handed. You broke the strength of the fatherless. That's why the snares are all around you. Why sudden peril terrifies you. Why so dark you can't see. And why flood of waters covers you. I think that's the end of what section, how did you label that in your lesson sheet? I like that. I'm always afraid now that these overheads are going to come up different. Okay, yes. Yeah, that's right. You must have been cruel and dishonest. All right, let's keep reading. I've only got 5 more minutes. This is not going to work. All right. I think the next section, pretty much, look down to verse 17. By the way, 16, interesting to me, might be a reference to Noah and the flood. As Eliphaz's example, would that be a good illustration of the theology of retribution? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Good people were saved, bad people were killed. Verse 17, they say to God, these wicked people, leave us alone. What can the Almighty do to us? And that's what Job said, isn't it? And Eliphaz quotes that back, said, yeah, that's what's wrong. That's what they do wrong. That's how God's going to punish them. And yet, you fill their houses with good things. And there's that phrase again, so I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. Are they making fun of one another? I don't know. It could be. I don't really know. But then, verse 19, Eliphaz says, but it all makes sense because the righteous see their ruin and rejoice. The innocent mock them, saying, surely our foes are destroyed and fire devours their wealth. So they really, God takes care of them. And the righteous people can look at them and mock them. How'd you label that one? That's not right.
11.
Yep, good, thank you. All right. And then, the last section is not a big surprise. It's been mentioned before. But I'll just emphasize, what did you say for the last section, this 20, verses 21 through 20, oh, 30?
Okay.
21 through 30, what would you put there?
Five.
Yeah. So, and you know, he said this before, but listen to the predictability they placed on God. If you return to the Almighty, verse 23, what?
You'll be restored.
You'll get everything back. Right. In verse 25, then the Almighty will be your goal. Surely you will find delight in the Almighty. You'll pray to Him and He will hear you. You will fulfill your vows, right? When men are brought low and you say, lift them up, then He will save the downcast. He will deliver even one who is not innocent. He will deliver through the cleanness of your hands. Okay, so He's kind of, as always, God is predictable. You did wrong, you had to punish. He's suffering. Now, if you just turn, you know He's just as predictable to reward you for that. That's kind of the sense of that. All right, Job, let's see. I think there's a connection between 22:13. You say, what does God know? Does He judge through such darkness? Job didn't actually say that. Did Job say that God can't see me, or did he say that I can't see God? I can't find God. Yeah, in fact, he's going to say more of that. I go east, I go west, north, I can't find him. His point is not that God is so far away He can't see us. It's that I can't find any evidence of His reasoning here. He feels separated through this darkness and mystery and His own tragedy. That's really not... But so, anyway, I think Job is going to kind of answer that to say, if only, verse 3 of 23, if only I knew where to find Him. I'm trying to find Him. I'm not saying He's so far away He can't see me and punish me. I'm saying I wish I could find Him, but I can't. Verse 8, if I go to the east, He's not there. If I go to the west, I can't find Him there. Verse 10, but what? But what?
He knows
the way I take it. You got it upside down, Eliphaz. I'm not saying He can't see me. I'm saying I can't figure it out and I can't find Him. So that's the idea, I think, in that whole thing. So what do you think for the first section of the Job speech?
Well,
yeah, if only I could find my case, but I can't find it. Okay. There's a lot of interesting things to read. And then go to verse 24, chapter 24. What's the key? Well, we should read this. This is like the pitiful statement of the world we live in, I think. Why does the Almighty not set times for judgment? I think He's just not fair. He is not running the world the way He should. Isn't that kind of the implication? I'm not reading, I'm sorry. That's not reading.
That's not fair.
Why must those who know Him look, in vain for those days? You know, kings would often set up a day, so, you know, on the third day of the month, for 2 days, I'm going to sit out front on my throne, you bring your troubles to me, I'll settle the cases, right? I think that was kind of a standard way. Where does God, when does God do that? Where you bring your case and He sorts it out and makes everything right. When does that happen? Men move boundary stones. You know, that's one of the most fundamentally corrupt things you could do in the Old Testament, because the land was going to be set out by God. And you move those boundary stones, you're stealing man's property, which was his life. Anyway, that was... They pasture flocks, they stole them. They drive away the orphan's donkey, take the widow's ox. They thrust the needy from the path, force the poor of the land into hiding. Like wild donkeys, they go in the desert. The poor go about their labor, foraging food. The wasteland provides food for their children. And he just describes this terrible fate of the poor. And by the way, how many people on the earth live that way, even today? Barely scraping out something from dusty ground, with children to feed and clothes hardly any closer to that. Doesn't that describe the world? And is it that way because there's not enough food in the world to go around, or because there are just men who... do the wrong things with it, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Verse 9, the fatherless child is snatched from the breast, the infant of the poor is seized for his death. Lacking clothes, they go about naked, they carry sheaves but still go hungry. They crush olives among the terraces, they tread the wine presses, yet they suffer thirst. They're slaves to other people. They make food for other people, they don't have enough. The groans of the dying rise from the city. Souls in our cities often the center of abuse like that, where people just come because they can eke out a living, but there's abuse there. The souls of the wounded cry out. Verse 12b is key. But what? God charges no one with wrongdoing. That's key. I mean, like I say, in the middle of his speech, that's kind of the key point he's making, right? That's what he's saying. And then he goes on to say there are people that rebel against the light. The theme of the next few verses is light and night. People hiding their evil in the night and rebelling against the light. In verse 15, the adulterer watches for the dusk because nobody can see me. Verse 16, in the dark, that's when thieves break into houses. You see that? There's this stuff. Yeah, what's going on in the dark is the wicked are hiding their wickedness is what's happening. Okay, what did you put for 1 through 17?
14.
Yes. God knows and control. What?
What are you doing? 23, 1 through 9.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, 12,
no,
4.
Yeah. That's 4. 14. Yeah, I skipped over 4. Yeah. Yeah, and anyway, that's it. To me, that is the crowning blow Job delivers to the theology of retribution. And isn't that a pretty powerful point? And anybody in this room going to disagree with that as the way the world looks and operates to the best of our knowledge? Does that seem fair? Does it seem like God's taking care of things the right way? Especially with darkness. And one interesting thing I'll look at a little bit in the speeches of Jehovah, there's only one little section where he talks about the affairs of men. And he uses the metaphor of a blanket that's crumpled up on a bed. You ever seen that? And you shine a light on it, and there's shadows that look like, it's almost like an aerial view of the earth in the morning from an airplane. Can you picture that? You know, like a blanket with wrinkles in it. And he say, can you take that blanket and shake it out so all those people are hiding in the cracks of darkness doing evil will just get thrown out into the light? Can you do that, Job? You see what he's saying? It's an interesting metaphor. I think maybe it relates to this. Bildad has really nothing to say. He has some verses, but have you ever heard this before? Verse 4. How then can a man be righteous before God? How can one born of woman be pure if even the moon is not bright and the stars are not pure? How much less man? Have we heard that before? It's Eliphaz's vision in some other form. We've heard it several times. And so that's this one. That's that. The only destructive... Oh, sorry, that's that. And then Bildad, Jehovah is high, man can never be just before him. That's just a reminder that we saw this before, beginning in chapter 4, verse 17. We've seen it again in the speech of Eliphaz, and we might see it again before the book is over. Okay, so remember before we talked about the various interpretations through the book. It's important. I think it's important. That's why it's in our catechism. But anyway, there's Bildad's speech. So 26 is puzzling, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it. Job acknowledges that Jehovah's power can be seen in our world. Again, for the first few verses of 27, I think it's a pretty clear, in fact, the word verse 5, 27:5, you know, you recognize our word there. I'll never admit you're in the right till I die. I will not deny my TAM, my wholeness. That's the word right there. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. Does Job think he's going to ever get his stuff restored?
No.
Does he think God is even fair?
No.
And yet he has not said goodbye to God. Does he still serve God? Okay. Does he still fear God? Read the next verses. Of course he does. That's what the whole next section is about. It's a praise of God's power. And yet he's getting nothing for this. Worse than getting nothing, he's getting negative. You know, and he actually doesn't think God is doing right, and yet he still serves God. You see, Satan's losing in this battle, even though he's kind of not ever again in the picture. Y'all see the point of that, maybe that's the way it would be. But anyway, in the latter part of this, and I really don't know how to make sense of 7 through 23, except for maybe this. I think what Job may be saying is, you know, really in the end, even if the wicked is kind of doing okay, and he goes all the way through and he comes to the end of his life in full vigor and peaceful with all his children around him, and he never really suffered anything, he has no friendship with God to count on at all. And if the least thing goes wrong, who is he going to call? And he doesn't have this inner comfort. Maybe that's what he's saying. And it's hard for me to point to a verse, and say, I might be able to find one. Maybe verse 20, terrors overtake him like a flood, a tempest snatches in the night, and so on. He just doesn't have the way to call on God. Maybe that's what Job is saying, but I don't know. And I'm going to put my hand over my mouth about this chapter. That's why some people would attribute it to Zophar and say, well, it's Zophar's last speech, because it's a little bit of the theology of retribution in here. But I think Job's mixing in the point that I'm retaining my integrity, staying with God. The wicked may not look like he's suffering, but the truth is he doesn't have the most important thing of all, which is the security that comes from being in a relationship with God.
verse 19, he lies down wealthy, but will do so no more. He opens his eyes and all is gone. It's almost as if all he really has is this outer world, but he doesn't have this inner peace. So, I don't know. That's maybe part of it. I don't know. All right, let's do the hymn. And I wanted to make sure we had time, and I almost did. I'll just tell you that all the shouting, and like I say, and I want to keep track of who's winning and who got the blows in and who blocked the blows and all that. I just need to get to chapter 28. Because let's just relax. And let's just kind of be calm for a second. I don't know who wrote this. I suspect the author did. Remember, I said that oftentimes in this literature, some of the most important stuff will be in the middle. And what comes after will further confirm it, but it may be that the heart of the whole point is in the middle. And that could be true about chapter 28. So let's listen carefully to it. I'll just go through quickly the logic of 28. In this, man can search out valuable treasure, and we're pretty good at it. Going where animals can't go deep in the earth. Gems, it's impressive what we can do. We go deep. However, you don't really end up understanding much more about the world doing that, of course. The height of ingenuity and technology and invention just doesn't get us anywhere in true wisdom. That is what this book is about. It's not found in the natural world at all, in fact. It's really above whatever you could buy or pay for with earthly treasures. Where do you find it? Well, not here, but here. That's kind of the way the poem will be structured. Only God has it. Why? Well, because he sees everything. He actually can see every single thing. Which, in a way, you have to be able to see everything, every single thing, to understand anything. You understand that? The complexities of the world, the interrelationships, and all of that. He has that wisdom because he made everything. And he started it all. He put his principles into the way the world works. So what's our job? Is it to figure that out? To recreate God's understanding? Not possible anyway. We weren't there at the beginning and since then. And we can't see everything all at once that's happening every day. So what is our wisdom? Remember our beginning point. It was that's kind of the central piece that holds all the wisdom together. Okay, let's read this. Maybe get done before we finish, just as a relaxer. and then we'll let Bill finish the rest of this when we come back again. First chapter 28. There is a mine for silver, and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken out from the earth, and copper is smelted from ore. Man put it into the darkness. He searches out the farthest recesses for ore in the black darkness. Far from where people live, he cuts a shaft in places untouched by the foot of man. Far from men, he dangles and sways. The earth from which the food comes is transformed below as by fire. Sapphires come from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts don't set foot on it. No lion prowls there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountain. He tunnels through the rock. His eyes see all its treasures. He searches out the sources of rivers, and he brings hidden things to light. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man doesn't comprehend its worth. It can't be found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not in me. It can't be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed out in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, with precious onyx or sapphires. Neither gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention. The price of wisdom is far beyond rubies. The topaz of Kush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds in the sky. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it. He alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. You see that what it takes to have that wisdom is just this kind of omniscience that says, I was seeing all of time and all of space
you know, across everywhere. Just the wander. You remember Satan? We saw in the very beginning, Satan wandered to and fro in the earth. He didn't sit up and watch everything. You remember that? And he doesn't know the future either, because he said this would happen and it didn't happen. About just what Job would do. He sees everything. When he established the forces of the wind, and measured out the water, when he made a decree for the rain. By the way, when we get to the Jehovah speeches, I might have mentioned this before, but we'll see it. There's an image there of the waters being kind of born and covered over with a baby blanket. And then they turn into a toddler and start banging against the walls of the ocean, you know, the shore. And God says, stop. Just don't go there. You know, he tells them no, and they have to stop, just like you would a toddler. It's kind of the picture. But he establishes the wind, measures out the waters. He made a decree for the rain, a path for the thunderstorm. And he looked at wisdom, which I think in this case represents the operating principles of the world, which are pretty complicated. I mean, we understand some of the natural laws, but really all the interactions and causes and effects that are designed into it. And he praised it. He confirmed it, and he tested it. And he said to man, try to be as smart as I am. Try to figure it out for yourself. He really did say any of that. It's a very simple instruction he gave to man, which was, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. Do you recognize these two phrases? Well, yeah, I mean, it's in these other books, but I mean from the book of Job. Job was an upright man, blameless, who feared God and shunned evil. So, that was the introduction. So our integrity word, and then these two other characteristics that were the reflection of that integrity, which is that he feared the Lord and he shunned evil. And this was the point we made at the very beginning about these books. And that principle right there is the thing that ties together all these other books. So in Proverbs, yeah, you can be clever and you can make a lot of good decisions and they'll turn out pretty good in your life. And that's what Proverbs is telling you to do. And it often happens that way. And really, but the beginning of that, of following these instructions and believing that it will turn out good, is believe that God made the world and there's wisdom built into it. And it will work out good because he's the best guide for how to live in it. And that's the beginning of knowledge. In Ecclesiastes, you know what, when you begin to feel empty and say, I don't know what the point is, I'm doing pretty well, but who's going to get all this stuff when I die? And what are they going to do with this big business that I built? My sons and their, what are they going to do with it when I go? They're going to waste it, you know what I mean? They're going to make a mess of things. But yet, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And then when you get to Job, that's kind of the message there too. And so 28 is it's an interesting place in the book, because we're going to have to step back out and let Job make some more assertions as a closing argument. Then we have to step back out even further and let Elihu shout at us for a while. He's trying to hold his tongue. He's over behind those three guys, been holding his breath and probably jumping around like he has to go to the bathroom because he can't hardly stand it. Keep them quiet, and you can see that they're just getting defeated, you know, out of their argument. And yet, we get this chapter as a kind of relief in the whole book. So, does that help you at all? We're not ready to answer it, but I'll just say, I hope this all will fit together at the end. And I do think 28, and of course the speeches of Jehovah at the end, the conclusion of Job, I think that makes it pretty obvious how to get out of this, what's it called, a escape room. How to get out of the escape room, comments. I'm too fast trying to get out.
Without 28, to say 28 wasn't there, it'd be difficult to keep going on. It's almost like this ray, like everything's been miserable. And it's like, we've got, you know, all the reasoning and Job got in, and then someone, it's like this information that says, here's this, and it kind of helps you to keep going on, because it's just been miserable. Without it, just, like, you don't get an answer, but you get something to hold on to. Before you just, everything you have, there's just nothing to hold on to.
Yeah, in a sense, you hear Job's arguments, you say, man, that's a pretty good point. Did he make it any headway with these guys? I mean, one way to look at it is, they're kind of doing this, really. And so if you're hoping for some resolution where Job finally conquers them with his logic, and they repent in dust and ashes, that's not going to happen. Y'all, how many of you listen to it on audio? Are you trying that just for fun? Does it calm you down? You know what I mean? I mean, it doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. And you kind of keep hearing the same things over and over as well, where we've seen the repeated argument. There's nothing peaceful about reading these arguments, and they're not getting anywhere. In fact, you kind of, I think by the end of the third speech, as you realize, you know, Zophar's just shouting the things he shouted before. He's not even being logical. And Eliphaz is just, what's it called, Mason? Ad hominem attacks. He just stops talking about the logic. He starts saying, Job, you're just terrible. You're wicked. He lists all the things he imagines Job must have done. And so they're outside of the realm of logic. And so maybe your point is, I think we all did need a break, you know, to see 28. Yeah, other thoughts about that? We're not done. I'm not saying this is the end of the book. It's the middle of the book. But still, it's real important for how this all fits together.
So, it, in some ways, it almost functions as a hypothetical, like, how would we find the answer to this discussion if an answer were available?
You mean, like, we dig deep for it, or...?
Well, or, right. Not, but in a, in, but the conclusion, of course, is that we don't really have the answer, per se,
that's right.
But the path we should pursue to find one would look like this.
Which is... fear in God, keeping His commandments. And maybe then things will make sense. It doesn't really say that, but maybe that's a path to follow. Certainly is the path Job is taking. And I hope I made enough of a point about the fact that Job continues to demonstrate, and we skipped over a lot of those verses where his praise of God is just pretty spectacular, despite everything going wrong. And how much hope does he have that he's gonna, this is all going to be made right? You covered last time maybe this hopeful thought that, you know what, you know, just doesn't make sense that life would be over and over yet. There must be something after life. And I know this, and I think Job is actually speculating, maybe reasoning, deducing there must be something after death. But that's not the view, the world view of his friends or Job, is that death is the end. And whatever he got in this life, whatever reward he had, whatever pleasures he had, that's all there is. And he has been denied that. And yet he's still serving God. I can't believe I'm done early.
Well,
I was so afraid, you know.
Why do you not think, I mean, that Job, why do you don't think Job wrote 28?
It's just too peaceful. I mean, you're right, it kind of does. For example, there's an interesting thing, which I don't understand why this is there, 27:1. You see that? I mean, if it's Job still speaking, why did the author have to say, and Job continues his speech? Now, that language is used when God continues his speech, you know, because it's in pieces later. But why did he need to say that there? That's not typical of his speeches. But he didn't say it there in 28, you know, why didn't... But I mean,
in 29.
So that suggests he maybe comes back, I don't know.
He divided
the chapter. I know. But up.
I might even have another book for us, Job 6 or something.
Okay, so that, what are we supposed to say? That's a good question. But you didn't ask, did Job, you asked me, why do I think that? Because the tone is so different.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's just a piece. It's a piece. It just kind of zooms out. It's bigger than the whole story. It's outside the whole story. And it kind of draws, it kind of comes to a conclusion in the end. It doesn't mention any of the arguments really of before. There's no, you know, reference to the friends or any of the rhythm of the other speeches. That's my reason. But who did really say it? That's a good question. That's what we're supposed to say because we don't know the answer. Yeah. That is a good question. Anybody else's Bible say Job said this as a paragraph heading?
Yeah. Yeah, it says Job continues where his wisdom.
So that's the heading?
Yeah. But it doesn't use word, you know, the other ones, you know, I and when I and this doesn't have that. It's almost like somebody broke in to put this in here because, like I said, it was just it was just awful.
Yeah.
And this gives you, if there's some hope in this, just some things about God that they kind of talked about. But it's kind of, it's put in a like a little bit more organized setting, a calmer way of looking at some of the
He doesn't really support any of the arguments.
No.
Even Job's. He doesn't support his argument that he's not being fairly treated or that he's right.
No, that's what Tim was. Yeah, I did not. Those two, I think, I was wrong.
Yes,
it was.
That's what he said.
Okay.
So
he can't believe the
picture. Let's skip this chapter. Let's skip the hard chapter, which I can't understand.
That's what you do. You go back to the hard one after the test. You finish it.
Me too.